from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio, this is Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer, in this week for Michael Krasny. In this hour, Republicans soul-searching. Last week's election results have left the grand old party wondering what went wrong. While some blame Hurricane Sandy or even New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, others acknowledge the party has a fundamental problem with minorities, women, and younger voters. Can Republicans regain their mojo by just tweaking their positions on issues like immigration and abortion? Or is the problem bigger than that? We'll ask a cross-section of Republicans, and we want to hear from you as well. We'll get started with Forum right after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, this is Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer, sitting in this week for Michael Krasny. Well, from Sacramento to Washington and many points in between, Republicans are wondering why voters so roundly rejected their message on Election Day, especially in the race for president. But Republicans also had problems in down-ballot races for Congress and the U.S. Senate and the state legislature right here in California. And all of it leaves the party of Reagan wondering what they stand for and what they must do to reach a broader cross-section of voters. Joining us to talk about the party's future, Bill Whalen, research fellow at the Hoover Institution. He joins us this morning by phone. Good morning to you.
Hi, Scott.
Also joining us by phone, Abel Maldonado, the former lieutenant governor of California, former state senator representing the Central Coast, who recently in this last election ran and lost for a race for Congress in the 24th Congressional District in Santa Barbara and San Luis Obispo counties. Good morning to you. And also with me here in the studio, Steve Grand, a GOP media consultant, president of Wilson Grand Communications, who has worked with many on different campaigns, including Karl Rove's American Crossroads. Good to have you with us as well.
Thanks, Scott.
Let me begin with you, Steve Grand. You know, starting with election night, there have been different interpretations of the results. Some say, hey, you know, it wasn't that bad. It was actually fairly close in the popular vote. Others say, no, it was a sound rejection. I mean, how do you see just the results? I mean, how bad do you see it having been?
Well, I think both points are true because you have the Electoral College and you have the popular vote, and those are two different measures. But in the end, it was a pretty good thumping. And I think we have to take some lessons from that thumping. We have to realize that I think we were off a bit in our messaging. We were talking to a group of voters that was more narrow than the group of voters we should have been talking to. We should have been reaching out better to women. We should have been reaching out better to Latino voters particularly. And I think slight alterations in our messaging and our focus could have made a big difference with some of those close losses swing state by swing state.
When you say slight alterations, give an example or two.
Well, I think we needed to not scare women away. And unfortunately, and this wasn't the whole party speaking, this was two bad apples in the basket, but we had two different U.S. Senate candidates make highly repugnant comments about rape. And I think those two comments got a lot of attention, a lot of press, got spread around, and it said to moderate women, We're not going to be happy here.
But it wasn't just those two. I mean, Mitt Romney talked about ending funding for Planned Parenthood. I mean, he sort of tried to come back to the middle. But women were listening, paying attention during the primaries.
Absolutely. And I think, again, I think the party's got to be bigger tent. I think the party's got to have a place for people who are pro-choice and pro-life. I think there's also a lot of strong messaging to women about the future, about their families, about the economy. And I think we pushed there, but the other side tended to not want to talk about those economic issues that affected the lives of people out there in America and their families and their future and the debt that their kids were going to have to absorb. But rather, they kept going to these social issues that are divisive.
And, you know, there after these kinds of elections, there's a lot of, hand-wringing and discussion. And there will be some who say that Mitt Romney made the mistake of coming back to the middle. That he wasn't conservative enough. I mean, is there any credence within the party to that? I mean, is anyone is that message getting legitimized in any way?
I think there will be people to the far right of the party that will say he shouldn't have shifted back. But I think that's who Mitt Romney really was. And I think when he found his stride in this campaign, in that first debate, he finally kind of got comfortable in his own skin. I think to get through the primary process, unfortunately, he did tack further right than he was personally comfortable with. And I think by the time the campaign really got into full-blown movement, we were in the debate process. That's when Romney found his voice, and that's where he had his comfort zone.
Bill Whelan, there's a lot of discussion now. We've seen some of the quickest evolution I've ever seen from people in the Republican Party saying they're now for comprehensive immigration reform. Do you see it? Do you see that as the key, that shift? I mean, everyone's talking about the rise of Latino, Hispanic voters. I mean, do you see it as so simple as tweaking the position on immigration?
No, because in part, as Steve alluded to, there's a problem with women and an additional problem with Latinos. I'll give you another group there's a problem with, and that's Asian Americans. Romney got 55% of the vote with people who make $100,000 or more. Asian Americans, Scott, are the highest per capita income voting group in America. They're also a very strongly knit family community. You would think there'd be a natural affinity to Republicans. Romney actually did worse among Asian Americans than he did with Hispanics. So I think you have to look at this as a much broader picture than just Hispanics. I think, not to get too far ahead here on the program, but I think Republicans have to look in three directions. One is, I think, as simple as the age of our nominees. We're now in a post-Cold War America. We're running candidates in the 60s and 70s. Democrats are running candidates in their 40s and their 50s. They do a better job than we do of relating to middle-class families, people raising kids and so forth. Romney was a grandfather in this election. Obama was a father. I think there's something to be looked at there. Secondly, we have to look at candidates with stronger biographies. It was at all times hard to market Mitt Romney. He just didn't, in this sort of People magazine age in which we live, he didn't have, you know, a sad story to tell us, a compelling story to tell, something to draw us in. So we need somebody who has a stronger Only in America kind of biography. And then thirdly, and this gets into, I think, the question of Hispanics and women, we have to have a more transformational message. We have to, at a minimum, show the American people that the Republican Party is just, it's changing, it's evolving.
You say that we need to select, nominees of with those characteristics. But, I mean, hey, it's the voters that make these choices. It isn't the party bosses, right? I mean,
That's true, but it's also a question of who's going to choose to run. And, you know, we can talk about the various failings of Mitt Romney and the Republican Party in general, but let's just go back to the primaries and look at the choice that Republicans gave the people in their primary. Mitt Romney, Newt Gingrich, Rick Santorum, Herman Cain, just a whole list of candidates who are all just very flawed in various ways.
Yeah. Let me bring Abel Maldonado into this. You are in many ways the kind of candidate Bill Whelan just described. You're about in your mid-40s, I think?
I'm 44 years old.
Okay, you're in your mid-40s. You're Latino, son of immigrant farmers. You are a moderate. You voted for a tax increase in Sacramento, for which I think you were punished in some ways by people in the party. You supported the top two primary. You supported, I think, the citizens redistricting. And yet you lost your race. And I wonder how much of that you think was because of the R after your name down there in the Central Coast.
I think, Scott, the R is a big factor within my race. At the end of the day, I put my political campaign headquarters right at the heart of the Hispanic community. I'm talking about in the heart of the Hispanic community where some folks didn't want to go because they didn't think it was safe. But yet the Hispanic community was very happy that I was there. I did everything to communicate, to walk precincts, to involve the Hispanic community, involve the minority community, and it kept coming up. It said R by your name, Abel, and it's unfortunate. And I tried as much as I could to explain to them that in order to have a strong, vibrant Hispanic community, you need a strong two-party system so there's competition. But they didn't. At the end, they didn't want to hear it. Some of the words that were said by our nominee at the top of the ticket were never recoverable. I mean, this auto deportation, I heard it every single day. And those are issues that we have to overcome as a party. And the question is, how do we do it? How do we make ourselves stronger? Because we do need two strong parties. It's better for California. It's better for America.
You also did have, I think John Boehner came down to the district to do a fundraiser with you, perhaps Daryl Issa, if I'm not mistaken. And how hard is it for a moderate Republican to sort of get away from the policies, the politics, the rhetoric of some who are to the right of you in the party?
Well, Scott, I can say that as much as you need the resources to run a campaign, it's you're on a wire when you're walking, where in fact you want to raise the resources, but you're concerned also some of the policies or politics of people that come in to help you. I think one of the biggest problems that's facing today, as you know, I wrote the open primary in California, which is I think something that's very, very good, not only for today, but for its future. But when you have our nominee during the process having to go so far to the right that, and have to say some things in order to make the primary, it's super hard to come back to where you really are the center to make any sense. So while it's great to have folks come in that'll help you raise resources, it's a balancing act, because at the end of the day, they see those as hard right, and they try to distinguish yourself. Abel, you did this, you did that, but yet you're going to go here. And if you look at the last commercial that was run in my district, the last closing commercial was very basic. It was, you can choose my opponent and Barack Obama, or you can choose Abel Maldonado and Mitt Romney, which at that point in time, I said, two things are going to happen. My polling's very right, and I'm going to win, or my polling's way wrong, and I'm going to lose. Well, you know what happened. The latter happened.
Yeah, that's Abel Maldonado, former lieutenant governor of California, ran and lost for the 24th congressional district seat down in Santa Barbara and San Luis Obispo. Steve Grand, you know, we heard a lot, especially in states run by Republican governors, about voter ID laws, efforts to make it harder for people to vote if they didn't have the proper identification, under the guise of preventing fraud, which many reports indicated really wasn't a big problem. And then we saw huge lines in places where that was tried, in Ohio and Florida. I wonder to what extent you think that backfired, and that was part of the problem, where minority voters and even women and others who might be sympathetic, independent voters, middle-of-the-road voters, who saw those kinds of things as, you know, kind of underhanded, kind of nasty. To what extent do you think that hurt the party?
Again, I think it all became part of this picture that said to a lot of middle-of-the-road voters who don't pay attention to politics on a daily basis, that they just weren't welcome in the Republican Party. And again, there it got ginned up. The other side picked up on this and made it a major part of their message. But the whole puzzle fit together, and the overall image was, you women, Latinos, African Americans, none of you are really welcome in the Republican Party. And I think, again, we just need to pull back from that and change the tone. And I think we can.
Bill Whelan, if you look at some of the swing states, and I'm thinking Ohio, Iowa, Wisconsin, where the president won, they all have Republican governors. And I think some of them, if not all of them, have Republican legislatures. So why that disconnect, do you think? Why do the Republicans do better? I mean, they have 30 governorships after this election, which I think is a record. Why the difference between the presidential nominees and the more local statewide politics?
For the reasons that Steve just alluded to, governors are very successful at running state-specific campaigns, education, pension reform, spending. Romney had a very difficult time. This was another problem with the Romney campaign. I don't want to turn this into an hour beating up on poor Mitt Romney, but Romney was not a transformational candidate. He was not necessarily running a strong policy-based campaign. He was a candidate born of the moment, like a John Kerry in 2004, even John McCain in 2008. And historically, those kinds of candidates just don't do too well. So Republican governors do well in these various swing states because they come in with very specific set ideas. Our presidential candidates could have to do the same.
Yeah. One of the other things that I've heard is that it's not just immigration that is alienating, say, Latino, Hispanic voters, Abel Maldonado, but also the economic message that whether it's Asian Americans who may be doing better economically or Latinos, they hear people like Mitt Romney or the party leaders focusing on sort of defending lower taxes for upper income people. And they feel that the party doesn't stand for people like them, middle class or, you know, lower middle class, working class people. What are your thoughts about that?
You know, if you really dig deep down, and I met with a lot of Hispanic folks within my community and in my district, and I actually had weekly meet and greets with 30 or 40 people that would show up, sometimes 50 people that would show up, come to see me, obviously as a former lieutenant governor, and knew that I was a candidate for Congress. And the question would always come up, how do you relate to me? What are you doing about immigration? You promised it. And then I would push back and say, you know what, our current president promised it too and didn't deliver the first year too, and we have massive deportations of Hispanics in America, and we don't have an immigration reform system, and I'd get them to think, and they would say, you're right, we would talk about a better education, and then I'd get into the notion of taxes, and, you know, to them, obviously, believe it or not, Scott, I voted for revenues in 2009. I was pillowed throughout the state, but when it got down to the Hispanic community, they were okay with it, and they were going to vote for Prop 30 no matter what. So there's this disconnect. While we have the same values, a lot of the same values of the Hispanic community, and I'm talking about the connection to the Republican Party, when it gets down to government, they do want services. They want a better education, and they don't care if they pay a little bit more. Obviously, Prop 30 to them was very important. And it gets to education, Scott. Education was a big issue in my district, and frankly, I didn't talk enough about it because I talked about the economy, I talked about jobs, and so forth. So those are issues that they care about, and we just have to communicate more. And you know what the bottom line is? A lot of folks came up to me and said, we're voting for you, and, you know, I don't like the R by your name, but just you showing up to my community shows respect, and respect goes a long way with the Hispanic community.
I want to bring in another voice now. Bridget Melson is active with the Tea Party in the East Bay, founder of the Pleasanton Tea Party. Bridget Melson, good morning to you.
Thanks for having me.
You bet. What do you see as the Tea Party's role, if any, in the outcome of the election at the national level?
You know, I thought that we would have a bigger voice with the GOP, and why, you know, I'm behind the scenes in politics quite a bit, and I understand that didn't happen.
What do you mean by a bigger voice?
That we would have more influence over them on the fiscal issues. I am also a very social conservative, and I think that is a big issue. Right now with the GOP, you know, I think the GOP just kind of doesn't have a market for what it's offering. And I think the Tea Party, if they would have listened, this would have never happened.
You're saying that if the Republican Party had followed the message of the Tea Party, they would have done better?
I think they would have. I do. And I think that this election was the time to do it, and I don't know that they can recover from it.
How do you square that, though, with what happened in Indiana and in Missouri, or for that matter, in Massachusetts, where Scott Brown was very popular with the Tea Party, ended up losing? But, you know, more to the point, in Indiana and Missouri, two seats that really many felt should have gone to the Republicans but didn't, because they nominated a Tea Party candidate who made some big mistakes.
Right. It doesn't mean that everybody in the Tea Party is going to, you know, be the best candidates. I don't know how well of candidates we are going to make, but I think with our support and our partnership with the GOP, we could have gone farther. Did some states try? You know, I don't know about those other states and how much they tried. I mean, I am, you know, involved nationally as well with the Tea Party. I can only speak for California here, where, you know, the partnership didn't happen. And, you know, to me, the bigger picture is that we've gotten away from the God and the ethics and the morals, and this country just doesn't want that anymore. So there's not a lot I think we can do to recover.
Steve Grand, do you agree with that? That either the Republican Party should have listened more to the Tea Party faction, or that there isn't really a market for the message that they're pushing?
I would say that certainly in the primary elections in certain states, there is a voice there. But unfortunately, that's been part of the problem, that when we get to a general electorate and you get to the overall view of the country, I think that the Tea Party has taken it too far to the right. I mean, we lost two seats this time in the Senate, no doubt. Last cycle, we lost Nevada. We probably lost Colorado. We definitely lost Delaware. There's five seats in the U.S. Senate that had we had more moderate Republicans running in those races, we would have right now. So we're down five because of those extreme politics in those primaries.
Bill Whalen, here in California, of course, the roots of the problem Republicans have with Latino voters is traced back to Prop 187 in 1994. And it seems like a generation of Latino voters now in California are, you know, solidly locked in with the Democratic Party. To what extent do you think what happened here in California over the past decade and a half has really rippled, you know, back over toward the rest of the country?
Not sure if you can hold up California as a national model, Scott. We have a Democratic governor and a two-thirds Democratic majority in each legislature, and I think there are 14 or 15 states in America that have the same all-Democratic lineup. Barack Obama got 60% of the vote out here versus, 52% nationally. The Hispanic problem is analogous, but again, I would focus you more on the women's issue. Pete Wilson was reelected in 1994, and he actually got more votes from women than Kathleen Brown did. Wilson's a pro-choice Republican. He ran a very simple slogan, the best governor for women, women happens to be a man, and he actually was on the plus side of the gender gap. Dan Lundgren ran in 1998, made abortion, he was pro-life, made abortion, his stance on it, the showcase of his campaign, a million women walked away from the GOP, and we've had a hard time getting them back. Donald Schwarzenegger got them back to an extent when he ran the two times in the recall and reelection, but they've walked ever since. So it's just a broader problem than Hispanics in California.
And would you agree, Steve Chase, or rather Steve Grand, that that women are really a key part of what the Republican Party has to do to become competitive again at the national level?
Oh, I think absolutely. I think we saw in a lot of states specifically, women were actually voting in considerably higher numbers than men. And again, I don't think it's a complete sea change, but I think we just have to stop offending them. And again, not as a whole group, but just there can be players in the party that make a gaffe and it reflects on the whole party.
Well, I hear you really focusing in on those two candidates, the Senate candidates, the two bad apples that spoiled the whole thing. I mean, is it really that simple?
I don't think it's quite that simple, but I think they had a big effect. I think overall the party has to be bigger tent. It has to have room for not only different issues on women's health, but also open up to other ethnic groups. I think that it just has to be. But I do think those two examples were the ones that were talked about time and time again, and became kind of the model of, oh, this is who the Republican Party is this cycle.
Abel Maldonado, what are your thoughts about that? About appealing to women? You ran against a woman, Lois Capps, which is tough.
Absolutely, it's very tough, and I think Bill is very right on the women's issue. We as Republicans have not done a good job of getting our message out. In fairness, he did talk about Pete Wilson, his campaign in 1994 about women. The registration in those days in California was around 6%. If I'm right or wrong, I'm not sure, but it's in that neighborhood. And ever since, the registration has completely dropped for the Republican Party. So if you look at all the candidates that have run after that, Dan Lundgren, Bill Simon, and Meg Whitman, they all lost by registration. Arnold Schwarzenegger won, but you can't. That's a totally different candidate there when you're talking about an international movie star. But you have a party in California with no infrastructure, no message, no pro message on what they're going to do. Fact of the matter, the message hurts the electorate, and no registration. If you look at what happened in my district in the last 30 days, I can't think of the exact number, but I think it was 10 or 15,000 new registrations. They did a fantastic job of reaching those. Most of those were not Republicans. We don't invest in that. So we've got to start from the bottom up, reach out to all these groups that we're talking about on this call, and get the party back. It has to happen. If not, I can tell you, it won't be long before the decline of states and no party preference folks take over the registration of second place in California.
Bridget Melson, just a few seconds left here. Do you think there's a chance that the Tea Party could sort of splinter off from the Republican Party and run its own candidates?
You know, that is a great question. That's something we have definitely been discussing. You know, there's a lot that the GOP, we would still like to partner with them. They need to rebrand. They need to do it now. Hopefully it's not too late, but definitely reaching women and the youth and immigration needs to change.
All right. Bridget Melson from the Tea Party over in Pleasanton, thanks so much for joining us this morning. And the rest of our guests will be with us for the rest of this hour. If you'd like to join us, the number to call is 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. Or you can email us. It's forum@kqed.org. Or you can leave messages on our Facebook page as well. I'm Scott Schaefer, here this week for Michael Krasny. Stay with us. And welcome back to Forum. Scott Schaefer here this morning. We're talking this hour about the future of the Republican Party in light of last week's drubbing at the polls in the presidential race. My guest this hour, Bill Whalen, research fellow with the Hoover Institution and a contributor at Hoover's Advancing a Free Society blog. Also with us by phone, Abel Maldonado, the former lieutenant governor of California, who ran and lost in this last election down on the Central Coast, running for Congress, lost to the incumbent Democrat there, Lois Capps. And also with me here in the studio, Steve Grand, a Republican media consultant and president of Wilson Grand Communications, who worked with many campaigns in this past cycle, including Karl Rove's American Crossroads. If you want to join us this morning, the number to call, 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. You can also email your comments to us. And let me just read a few email that we've gotten. Nancy writes, the Republican Party wants to find better ways to trick women, young people, and minority voters into voting for them. They keep talking about us as a problem for them. It's not the method of selling. It's the product they offer, she writes. Clarice in Palo Alto writes, the first speaker indicated the weakness was that they couldn't bring women back to look at the economy because they kept getting distracted by the divisive social issues. Those are the same social issues the Republicans have used for a few decades to motivate the religious base, and they've relied on for votes. Do they think women wouldn't notice? Let me ask you about that, Steve Grand, the whole religious aspect to the Republican message and the Republican Party and the base. Is that how big a problem is that, and how is that going to be get resolved?
Well, I think there is certainly a place in both parties for people who are religious, and I think oftentimes there's too large a focus on some of those social issues. And I think the party as a whole is the party of small government. That ought to be open to people who are deeply religious and who are not deeply religious.
Abel Maldonado, you know, the Republican Party for years has been saying, you know, it's just a matter of time before Latino voters come over to the Republican Party because they agree with us. They're socially conservative. They agree with us on abortion and gay marriage and those kinds of things. Is that your experience?
You know what? I do know that within our community, and I happen to be Hispanic, obviously un-American, but proud of my heritage. Let me just give you the playbook that we've been doing with Hispanics in the Republican Party for the last 10 years. 2 weeks before the campaign, you put up a bumper sticker that says, Viva the candidate's last name. You have a piñata party or some taco party. You have a mariachi band and you at a park, and you think they're going to come roaring to you. It's not going to happen. Hispanics don't want anything for free. They want an opportunity, and they want some respect. So just showing up is very, very important. Some of those issues within the Hispanic community are very, very important. I'd ask people, what's your position on abortion? They'd say, you know what, I'm very, very pro-life. I'm voting for Barack Obama. I said, what's the disconnect? The disconnect, they would look at me right in the face and say, it's your party. And I said, well, do you know the message of the party? No, don't want to hear it. What he was doing was repeating what the other party has put in his mind. Now, what has happened? We have not had people within our community go out there and talk to Hispanics face-to-face, go on their TV station, go on their radio station. I've been doing it, obviously, not enough. I'm one person. We need more within the state of California. And until we get more folks in line from the Hispanic side to join the party and be involved, we're going to have troubles. It's just the way it's going to be, Scott.
So you're saying that even though they may agree with you on some of those issues, they won't listen because of the party's image?
Well, it's the image. It's the branding they feel. I mean, I asked a couple of folks actually this morning, what was wrong with Mitt Romney? Why didn't you vote for him? Well, you know, I didn't like his 47% comment. Well, that was a big issue, and that was one of the issues that hit right at home. And they said, you know, if he doesn't care about us and he doesn't think we're going to be with him, why should we even consider him? And I'm not here to bash on Mitt. I think he's an upstanding man. He just had a tough campaign that he went through, and it just didn't fall his way. And, you know, some of the messaging that came out, Scott, was just difficult. It just could not recover. And I could feel it. Being myself, you got to understand that I speak perfect Spanish. It was my first language, and I had high hopes with getting. But every time at the end of the meeting was like, oh, I don't know if I can go there. Why? I just can't. I don't like the comments. I don't like this. Immigration reform, where have you been? It's a branding issue. We've got to, and I would make the point, Scott, you need two strong parties. If there's not a strong party, they'll take you for granted on the Democrat side. We understand, but we're not ready.
You say
so
it's
there
a,
you go.
You say it's a branding issue, but it's a philosophy issue too, isn't it?
It's a message issue, Scott. I mean, when you get out there,
but you can change the message, you know, easily enough. But you can't change the ideology overnight.
Well, put it this way: when you went to my victory party, which was not a victory party, you came to my event. There must have been 300 people. There, half of them were Hispanic and Latino. It was the district. Now you go to other, you know, you go to some other parties within the Republican Party. There's no diversity. There's no Big Ten. And I'm not saying you have to have it. What I'm saying is you have to reflect what the fastest growing population in the state is. And if you fail to acknowledge that, Scott, it's political suicide. And in some way, you do get to philosophy. You look at what happened across the border in Mexico. They had 71 years of one ruling party. They came back with 12 years of another party. Now they've gone back to the other party. So they're willing to go, but you have to have a message that resonates and one that you can be honest about with.
All right, let's go to the...
Something, Scott?
Oh, yeah, go right ahead. Bill Whelan, yeah.
You hear this talk about, well, Republicans just have to wait a generation or so, and then Hispanics will, you know, become higher earners, and they'll become more open to the taxation message and hostile toward government. But time is not on the Republican side. One of the takeaways from this election is that Barack Obama built a very effective firewall out here in the West. Not California so much, but Nevada and Colorado and New Mexico. That's 20 electoral votes. That's two more than Ohio. So he now has that to count on in Democrats may in future elections, and that's thanks to the rise in the Hispanic vote for Democrats. But the Republicans don't have time, and the reason being the great state of Texas, which is sort of last big bastion for Republicans. 9 out of 10 kids born in the last decade, according to the census, were born to Hispanic kids. In the next 10, 15 years, they will come of voting age. They will grow up in neighborhoods where one, two generations of their parents and grandparents have been voting Democratic, voting tending to be habit-forming. They'll probably vote Democratic, too. And a state like Texas, which is now reliably red, will slowly go purple and then eventually tilt toward blue. And if the Republican Party, looking at a national election, and in the beginning of the election, you lose California, Texas, Illinois, New York, Massachusetts, game over.
Yeah. And Steve Grand, you know, looking at the some of the exit polling, I mean, Obama got about 40% of the people earning more than $250,000 a year. I mean, it's not like all the millionaires voted for Mitt Romney.
Absolutely. I think, again, you're going to see party loyalties, certainly with a group of those people. I also, just to pick up on the last point, I also think we've got some pretty big star Republican Latino leaders out there that can help us keep moving this process forward. You got Marco Rubio in Florida. You got the new-to-be Senator Ted Cruz in Texas. You've got
a Tea Party favorite.
Yes, but also a Latino elected official. You've got Susana Martinez, the governor of New Mexico. You got Brian Sandoval, the governor of Nevada. So, I mean, there are leaders, and you know, you've got Abel Maldonado here. I mean, you've got people who we can put up and say, look, we do have leaders who are part of that community.
All right, let's go to the phones now. Jim in Fairfield, welcome. Good morning.
Thank you very much. My family has always been Republican. I was a third generation Republican, but I found I just could not stay with the party. I think they pushed me out rather than me leaving. If you're pro-environment or pro-education, the Republican Party seems really, really hostile to you. Drill, baby, drill, Arctic refuge drilling. And then as a teacher, I'm a public school teacher, it just seems like the entire message of the Republicans are that education is failing because of you blankety-blank teachers, and I just could not stay in the party. And it seemed like, again, for a lot of people, the Republicans in the state and nationally have been obstructionists rather than trying to get things done with government. Government is evil, and therefore we have to shut it down. And Abel Maldonado was talking about immigration reform. Obama tried immigration reform, but it was the Senate stalled it using a filibuster power. So it just seemed like I think the Republicans have lost their base because they seem hostile to what government can do. And that was seen with Hurricane Sandy, that government should rush in to help the states. The federal government should rush in to help the states. But the message of the Republican is that isn't a role for the government.
And
I'll take my comments off here.
Okay, thanks very much. I appreciate that. Bill Whalen, just to pick up on his comments, and I would maybe add to that list creationism, you know, and some of the opposition to evolution, or at least raising questions about evolution, and climate change, you know, really focusing in on the few, and I would call them fringy scientists, who say that climate change is still, you know, unclear. I mean, to what extent do you think that those kinds of positions, you know, some like David Brooks would say that it's, you know, sort of a denial kind of politics, is that pushing people away, women, young people, others?
Well, I'd probably look at it in terms of the generational vote, which again gets me back to this concept of running a younger candidate who can better relate to a younger generation's sensibilities and not forth. But, you know, for as much as we've been beating up on Republicans in this hour, and God knows we could go into 2 or 3 hours of doing this, the Democratic Party has problems going long-term, too. And their problem simply is that the next man or woman who seeks the party's nomination will not be Barack Obama and get some of the built-in advantages that he has running as a national candidate. But, again, we just, you know, as Abel has alluded to and Steve has alluded to, you have to go back to the message. And what the caller said about education is a great example. Republicans are not anti-teacher. What they have a problem with is the teacher's union, so they have to do a better job of explaining the excesses of what they perceive to be union power in Sacramento and nationally. Again, just tweaking the message at all times. And surely they're not necessarily an enemy of the worker. That's the same problem we've gotten into on immigration as well, where we're perceived as just being anti-immigrant rather than having a problem with the problem of legal immigration itself.
Steve Graham, what would you add to that? Especially around climate change, that's a big issue. The environment is a big issue for younger voters.
Again, I think that, and I agree with everything Bill just said. And in addition, I think that we missed it this time also with younger voters. That was the other place. That was why I think the Republicans thought they were going to win, was because they didn't realize the younger voters were here to stay. And I think we're going to focus more on the younger voters, realize that they are probably going to be more socially moderate. Things like climate change, I think for the most part, most of the people in the party are saying they accept the science. But
are they willing to support policies to address it?
I think so. I think as we become a younger party, as we embrace, which we have to, if we embrace a younger personality, I think we are going to look harder at these science questions and say we will do better there.
But how much of it is – yeah, go ahead.
Scott,
Abel?
Yeah. Abel.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you look at my voting record, 14 years in the legislature, and there was a study done, I was 50% right down the middle on all the issues when it comes to the environment, women's issues, immigration. I voted for revenues. I voted for a budget. I can go on down the line. I couldn't overcome this notion of not trusting that R next to my name, Scott. And that was a challenge for me because as much as I would go out there and tout about all the good things that we did on climate change, I've always said that I believe there is climate change. The question is, how do we fix it, number one? And how do we fix it in a moderate way where we still create jobs and don't push companies out of California and keep them here? That never resonated because at the end of the day, in the evening, there'd be some Republican somewhere saying that this, and they say, ha-ha. Abel's one of them.
Yeah.
It was just hard to overcome.
Steve Grant, how much of it, though, is, you know, all the parties, all the candidates need money to run, and the Republican Party tends to get money from coal, oil industry. I mean, to a certain extent, I'm just sticking with this issue here of the environment and climate change. I mean, there is going to be a push toward, you know, drill, baby, drill, the Keystone Pipeline, killing things like cap and trade or putting a tax on carbon. I mean, and that's just part of their own sort of self-interest because of where their money comes from, isn't it? And
well,
that's not going to change anytime soon.
Obviously, but they are.
And the same is true, by the way, on the left.
Exactly.
I mean, you know, there are special. I want to be clear. Yeah, and the pendulum will swing. We'll be having a show, I'm sure, not too long from now about all the problems in the Democratic Party.
But I think any of those given industries represent a small proportion of the money that comes in and is part of these campaigns, and they can have their agendas. I mean, something like Keystone is not necessarily going to kill the world. I mean, there were a lot of smart arguments in a lot of places where people believed that the president blocking the Keystone Pipeline was a bad idea, that it was not going to destroy the environment, and in fact was critical for economic development. So I don't think any single one of those is going to blow the thing up.
Yeah. All right, let's go to Nathan in Fremont. Good morning.
Good morning. Yeah, I had a comment, which is with regard to the vice presidential candidates in each of the last two cycles. I think this played a much bigger role than these analysts are giving it credit for. We had young, pretty, and divisive vice presidential candidates, neither one willing to give anything anywhere in their arguments and in their plans for the party.
Bill Whelan, how much difference do you think the vice presidential candidate makes? I mean, we're talking about Sarah Palin and Paul Ryan, two very different candidates, although certainly from the right part of the more conservative part of the Republican Party.
I would start by saying that if the vice presidential selection were the standard by which we chose the ticket, let's just look at Joe Biden and ask what America voted for so overwhelmingly for Barack Obama, with Joe Biden being the choice. The vice presidential pick just doesn't weigh in at the end of the day. It's I know people are kicking this around saying, well, maybe you should have picked Marco Rubio or Rob Portman, and why did you pick Ryan if you didn't really showcase Ryan? I hate to say it, it just doesn't matter that much.
Yeah. Do you disagree at all, Steve Grant?
I mean,
Sarah Palin maybe is unique because she really has shaped the image of the party.
Yeah, they certainly should do no harm. And I think we've had situations where they do harm. And I think I mostly agree with Bill here. The one thing is I think a Marco Rubio would have, I think, sent a message to the Latino voters about where the party thought it should be going. And so I think Paul Ryan was a strong choice. He's a solid guy. He has very clear thoughts on the economy, and that was a serious issue for the Republicans this time. I think Rubio might have sent a message, but I agree overall it probably would not have made.
Yeah, and he had his own set of issues.
Absolutely.
Too. Yeah. Let's go to Los Angeles now. Lee is online. Good morning.
Hi. I just wanted to ask, so far the emphasis has been on a failure to communicate or tweaking the message, which I believe is a delusional rationalization. What about the party's largely radical positions and policies? I'm a branding professional, and trust me, branding is not the problem. We've evolved, and Republican positions and policies don't address our need to come to terms with changing realities. They seem to be largely against education, social services, environment, gay marriage, abortion, immigration. These are irrelevant, retrograde, and radical positions. And what percentages of Republicans actually support marriage equality, freedom of choice for women, and increasing taxes to help pay for services that most of us need and rely on? Not to mention, you know, taxing those earning over $250,000, which many wealthy earners, even wealthy earners, support. So Hispanics, Asians, women, the working and middle classes, we're not easily fooled. Why do you think there's no diversity in the Republican Party?
Steve Grand, what do you think will be the fallout of this election in terms of social issues? And let's just pick a couple. Gay marriage, which, you know, historically the trend seems to be going in a different direction from the party. Although you wouldn't, you know, I think in the courts, and we saw, I think, four states essentially embrace gay marriage, or at least one rejecting a ban, Minnesota. Where do you see the party going? Do you see it just sort of ignoring those issues, letting them be, you know, just sort of not focusing on them?
I think that the party will look to its younger base. I think gay marriage is a good example where I think it's not going to be an issue in another generation. And I think the party will continue to be better about embracing gay marriage. I think within a decade, it's just not going to be an issue. And I think this notion of these radical positions, I don't think it is the whole Republican Party. I think there is a vocal minority. I think there is a talk radio shock jock approach that we hear a lot about, and people unfortunately think that's the whole Republican Party. But I think the party is a much wider place, and I think we need to just do a better job of talking to those people in the middle.
But if you look at Abel Maldonado, who many would say is part of that middle part of the party, Abel, would you say you were embraced by the leadership in Sacramento?
Obviously, I was there for quite some time, and when I voted for the budget in 2009, you know, I kind of became the person that nobody wanted to touch and said, well, this guy increased revenues, and all I can say is that I did increase revenues. We did it for an 18-month period. It was a stopgap measure. It was a sales tax. People crucified me for that. 7 days ago, the people of California voted for 5 years of tax increases, not a sales tax, a small portion sales tax, but for 5 years on high-income people who happen to be small businesses. So while you might be upset at me for what we did in 2009, which was something that we had to do, or it was shut down university systems or let prisoners out of prison and just, you know, hurt the education system, look what we have today. The voters were loud and clear. And I think it's a problem from the standpoint that Sacramento Sacramento can't even decide anymore. They're putting everything on the ballot. We elect people to do their jobs. They ought to be doing it up there. I think the Republicans could have come up with an agreement in the last year in Sacramento that moved on. Initiative wouldn't have been on the ballot. We would have been moving forward. But it's part of, we have some folks on one side of the aisle and frankly on the other side of the aisle as well who want to tug and pull a hard right or hard left. And when you do that, there's no reasonable people in the middle. There's no open-minded people. There's no common sense people.
All right, Lee, thanks very much for the call. Let's get another caller in here. Sunny in Berkeley. Hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I think that Lee really articulated my position well. So the only thing I want to add to that is I think progressives are just really elated by the level of analysis the Republicans are giving, because just changing the tone, stop offending women, Paul Ryan doesn't matter, those are just so shallow until they really address this deep-seated classism, racism, sexism, homophobia. They're just going to make themselves obsolete. So that's my comment, and thanks for the show.
All right, thanks. Steve Grand, you know, we do live in a little liberal bubble in the Bay Area.
Yes, we do.
But how big a problem are those issues in places like Iowa and Wisconsin and New Hampshire, for example? Does it add to the problem that the party has, some of those more extreme positions on those kinds of issues?
Again,
or is it more that when at heart, is it really economics?
I think that's where the party is trying to talk. I think that's where the party is focused, is let's fix this economy. Let's try to start getting rid of the debt and the deficit that is going to bury our children and our grandchildren. And I think oftentimes it's the other side that wants to bring up these social issues that can be divisive.
The other side, but, meaning Democrats?
Yes, and I think it's
well,
unfair.
Well, but in fairness, I mean, looking back, say, to 2004, I mean, gay marriage was a huge issue that the Republicans brought up. It wasn't the Democrats.
True. But I think in certain states it's going to be different. In the red states, just like in the blue states, there's going to be very little agreement. But I think as you get to the middle, as you get to these swing states, it's the economy that should be the focus. And I think to say that the whole Republican Party is racist and sexist and homophobic is just not fair, and it's not true.
Yeah.
Scott, can I add something?
Yeah, Bill Whalen, go ahead.
You know, we're talking about the Republican Party reaching across the aisle, reaching toward the middle and building a broader consensus. I think we can agree that both parties actually did a rather miserable job of that in this election. You know, the president ran a base campaign, and Romney ended up running largely a base campaign, too. Just look at the numbers. For all the money that Romney spent, $1 billion, and all the ways he was not going to be the John McCain campaign, he actually got 2 million votes fewer than John McCain did in 2008. But look at the president's side. For the talk about the president being transformational and wonderful and larger than life, he got 9 million fewer votes than he did in 2008. He lost about 13% of his vote. So I would suggest that, you know, we can focus on the failings of the Republican Party, but I'd say that both parties actually are kind of disappointing the American people, and you see that in these, you know, lower turnout numbers.
One of the things, of course, the main thing that the government is going to be facing in the next couple of months is this fiscal cliff. And I think we're going to have an opportunity to see what lessons have been learned from both the president and the Republican leadership in Congress. Bill Whalen, starting with you, how do you think, given what happened in the election, how should the Republican Party approach this this problem the country is facing over the deficit, entitlement reform, tax reform, and so on?
I think you probably see it pretty clearly in what John Boehner has said so far, where he's gone out and, you know, staked out his position on higher taxes. But if you read between the lines, he's clearly signaling to the president that he's willing to sit down and play ball with him.
Although he isn't, I mean, maybe this is just a public first step statement.
It is exactly a public first step, just as the president did his press conference the other day, and just absolutely, you know, no way in hell am I going to, you know, move on taxes myself. And but this is how Washington works. You both stake your position, and then you sit down and you lead. And that's the question going into this. It's, you know, it is a dance, and somebody has to lead when two people dance. Not to be a partisan here, but I think it's the president to lead on this. He is a commander in chief. He is the one who won the election, and, you know, Congress is a herd of kittens at the end of the day. The president has to be the one who pushes the process.
And what do you think he learned or should have learned from this election?
Well, again, it's a tricky thing because you've been reelected. You've been minted. You're not going to be a historical failure now. First-term presidents or one-term presidents are always historical failures. Now you're a second-term president. So, you know, the world is his oyster. But that said, he should look at the numbers and see that he got 13% less. He ran against a very weaker opponent, and while he did win a big electoral vote, it was not a sweeping, overwhelmingly popular vote. So he should be a little bit humbled, if you will. Again, hard when you're the most powerful man in the world. So he should have the Republicans down. He should have Boehner down to the White House, have dinner with him, talk to him, and start figuring out ways to work ahead. The choice is either do it now, do it with this window of the fiscal cliff, and maybe take that into a larger ticket of tax reform, or wait until 2014, which historically is a bad election cycle for incumbent presidents, second-term presidents. Their sixth year usually gets slaughtered, and then wait until 2015, and with his, you know, kind of hat handed to him, try to compromise with Republicans. I'd like to see them do it now rather than do it later.
Steve Grand, there may be a temptation on the part of the Republicans to see if they can drag this out a bit. Maybe the climate will change, and soon they'll be into the 2014 elections, where we might have a more favorable electorate for the Republican Party. What would you like to see your party do over the next several months?
Well, I think in the end, they have to step up and they have to stop the fall off the fiscal cliff. That just has to happen. And so, and I think the voters as a whole for years now have been really unhappy with the way Washington has not worked, that it's been so dysfunctional. The president ran 4 years ago saying he was going to make it work. It hasn't. And I think Boehner's got to step up. And I agree, Congress can be like herding kittens, but he's got to get his Congress behind him, and I think he's got to negotiate. And I think the American people are looking for both sides to step up, make some compromises, and do what's best for the country.
What role do you think business will play? The president is meeting with CEOs this week, Wednesday, at the White House. I mean, does business and Wall Street, do they need to play a role here in getting these two sides together?
I think yes. I think the president, I think, cares about his legacy. And as much as there might be a few news clips about another resounding victory in a political campaign, in the end, if he leaves this country $20 trillion in the hole, that is not going to be a very good legacy. So I think in the end, he wants to see accomplishment here too. And I think all the parties need to come to the table to help.
Yeah. And then just quickly, Abel Maldonado, well, we're looking at supermajorities in Sacramento for Democrats, and we're really short on time here, but in a word or two, what does your party need to do to change the dynamic up there?
Well, first of all, we obviously need to rebrand from the standpoint we need to focus on registration, get a better message, a positive message, put some infrastructure in place. You know, I did the open primary in 2009 to allow people to govern. And right now, under the system that we had prior to 2009, before the open primary, you couldn't govern, Scott,
yep,
because you had hard right and hard left.
Yep.
And Washington right now is where we were in 2009.
Yep.
We were on the verge of bankruptcy in February of 2009. We had no money the way we budgeted.
Abel, I got to stop you there. I'm sorry. We're out of time. But I'm sure the discussion will continue in Sacramento and elsewhere. Abel Maldonado, a former lieutenant governor of California, thanks to you, to Bill Whalen, Bridget Melson, and Steve Grand as well. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell. Tina Lauberg and Irene Noguchi. Our executive director is Dan Zoll. I'm Scott Schaefer. Thanks for listening.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Schrem, owners of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.